very quickly my story. So if we can go to the first slide. I was born in Yorkshire. That's Beverley. That's where I was born. I was born in Beverley rather than Hull because there was a maternity, a specialist maternity unit in Beverley. I was one of twins, identical twins, and being awkward, we were both breech. So my poor mum had a real job giving birth to me and my brother. But that's why I was born in Beverley in East Yorkshire. I grew up near in around Hull. And I'll come on to that in a moment. But people often ask me then if I'm an identical twin. Oh, go on then. You must have some embarrassing stories. So let me just as a little aside tell you the most embarrassing story, the worst thing that my brother has ever done to me. I've been married for a year. He was yet to get married. And he arrives, and I was living in Oxford. He was living down in Guildford. And he arrives in Oxford for a day out. He's going to come to see us in the evening. And he's walking through Oxford High Street with his girlfriend, with his arm around his girlfriend. Now, I'd just been asked to be one of the leaders of this church. I was only quite young in Oxford. And somebody comes up to him and gives him the weirdest look. And he's looking and says, "Oh, hello, Richard." Thinking he's me. And my brother decides, out of the kindness of his heart, to drop me in it. So he proceeds to engage this person in conversation like he's me, whilst having his arm round this other girl, obviously not my wife. And he says, and as I walked away, I thought, I'll go for a bit of theatrical finish. He turned and gave her a kiss. Then he phones me up. Say, "Hey, Rich, I've so dropped you in it. You just wait. The church is going to be on to you." I don't know to this day who that person was, but there was obviously someone who now thinks within a year of getting married, I was having an affair with somebody and walking down the Oxford High Street with them. But that's what my brother did. That's the worst thing he's done to me. Okay, so I was born in Beverley, and then we grew up, if we just go to the next slide, near this, the Humber Bridge. Grew up just outside Hull. And I was an atheist. I didn't believe in God. My family didn't believe in God. We had nothing to do with the church. Just assumed that science had proved that God didn't exist. It was all a load of rubbish. It was all a fairy tale. And just to get on with life. And the main focus of my life was about working hard at school. That's what my parents were encouraging me to do. My dad was in the Merchant Navy. My mum was a secretary. And they were really sort of encouraging my brother and I to work hard at school, get good jobs. And the main focus, where we would find happiness, was by earning a lot of money. That was it. That was my sole kind of like focus on life, was working hard with a goal to make money. And I was umming and ahhing when I was 16. Do I become a lawyer or do I go for science? I was good at science, but I was doing all right at the other stuff as well, so I thought, well, I could go either way. And I was quite attracted to the law thing because I'd read this article about this QC who was earning over 100 grand at the time. So I was thinking, oh, that sounds quite good. I could have a bit of that. But then also I quite like science as well. And into our school, as I start sixth form, I'm doing maths, physics and chemistry A level, comes this new deputy head. He's only young, 34. And he's a doctor. He's a doctor of physics. And as well as teaching me A-level physics, this guy has a little research group. If you go on to the next slide. And they're making these things, solar cells. This has been his research whilst he was doing his PhD, his doctorate at university. He'd been making solar cells. And he'd gone to Durham University to do this. And he starts, every school he'd been at, and he did the same with our school, he starts a little group to make these things in sixth form group to make these things in lunchtimes. So I'm part of this little group and we're doing this sort of science. If we go on to the next slide. And here I am. Newspaper article, slightly grainy. That one, if you any doubts, that's me, all right? Not that one. There I am. Back, that will be about 1980, I'm just working it out, 1983. And that's us making some solar cells in that. Because we were making these solar cells, and we ended up being invited to a European conference in Athens with these things. So it was kind of like making the local papers. So there I am in the local paper, one of these people doing this stuff. But the thing with this guy, I found out he was a Christian. He was the first Christian I'd ever known. And what we did is we ended up being entered into a public speaking competition around Yorkshire because this was so novel. And we won it in the end, this thing. And we're going around different places doing this. We would go around, me, my brother, and another sixth former, and this guy, at the time, he had a metallic green mini metro. It was such a teacher's car. No one's a teacher, are they? Are people teachers? Anyone teach? All right, okay. Yeah, it was a real teacher's car. Like, rubbish. So he's in this car. We used to go around, and we would talk driving around. We'd talk about stuff, you know, just not just school stuff. And my brother and I, both atheists, would grill him. As much as you were allowed to, we'd take the mick about his faith and why he was a Christian. Why did he believe in a fairy story and this sort of stuff? And he would come back at us. And then we find out that this guy, his long-term plan, he's going to become a head teacher. Then he's going to take a 60% pay cut and become a vicar. That's what he wants to do. Now I'm thinking, okay, now this guy doesn't just believe in fairy stories. He's a nutter as well, because he wants to take such a big pay cut. Why on earth is he doing this? But as he talked, there was just something about him. I'm thinking, what is it you've got that I haven't got? And I could never put my finger on it. Anyway, he had such an influence on me, I decided that I would go. If you just go on to the next slide. To this place, Durham. And do exactly the same degree that this guy had done, applied physics. And this is what I went and did. I didn't end up then doing research on solar cells, but I went to Durham. And whilst I was at Durham, at the beginning of my second year, one of my mates came back to announce to everybody he'd become a Christian. Now, this was the first person I'd ever heard use that phrase, "I've become a Christian." I'm thinking, you know, what on earth have you done? Why would you do that? But this guy, the thing about him was that this guy was changing. It was like he was changing from the inside out. And I couldn't understand what was going on. He became my best friend. His name was Royston. And we would talk long into the night over coffee about God and stuff. And I began to realize that this guy, you know, he said to me, "You know, Rich, Christianity isn't a religion." I said, "Of course it is. I did RE at school. It's one of the five major world religions." He goes, nah. "No, it's not really a religion. A religion will give you this list of rules, do's and don'ts. But this is a friendship. I've got a relationship with God. And he's forgiven me for all the stuff I've done wrong. And it's kind of like a clear relationship. And he's got a plan and purpose for my life." And then he would introduce me to other Christians. And these would really annoy me. Two reasons. They have these smiles. That used to annoy me a bit. But the other thing that really, really bugged me was I was doing quite well at uni, and I knew I was going to get a better degree than them. I ended up going to Oxford to do a doctorate. I would get a better degree than them. I would earn more money than they would. But they all seemed to be contented and have a purpose in life that I had never found. I had not found contentment. I had no sense of purpose in life. And these guys had it. And I was thinking, that's not fair. You guys have got this, and I'm working my butt off to be the top dog in the degree course, and I'm going to get this, you know, a job and earn loads of money, and you've got it, and I haven't. What is it with you guys? And then you also have these smiles. So they used to annoy me, but there was something that intrigued me about them as well. And so over sort of 18 months, I investigated. I read lots of books. And as you start to investigate, you realize that Christianity isn't just a fairy story. It's based on history, that Jesus Christ really is a historical figure. You start to focus in on him because you think, well, it's called Christianity, so he's obviously the central figure. So let's have a focus in on him. So I focus in on him. And you get to the point where you focus down onto the resurrection. Now, I'm a scientist, right? So everything was all about proof and evidence. So I was looking, okay, these guys claim that he came back to life. That's the key thing. If he did, then there's something. Do come on in. Yeah, come and join us. We're just telling stories. So I focused in on that and started to investigate that more. And the more I read about it, the more I started to think, you know what, all the other options, the disciples nicked the body. He wasn't really dead. All these other options about the empty tomb. Because the empty tomb, there's such clear evidence that the tomb was empty on that Sunday morning. You can't deny it. And you start to go through the options, and they all fall apart, except for the one that I thought, well, that's the unbelievable one. The unbelievable one is that he could have possibly come back to life. And in the end, I got to the point thinking, I think he did. Oh, poo, is what I thought. I think he did. So I prayed that night. It was the second time I prayed. The first time I prayed, was when I crashed my dad's car, and I prayed that the dents would miraculously disappear overnight. Sadly, God did not do a miracle that night. So a bit of a shame. So this was the second time I'd ever prayed in my life, and I prayed this: okay, Jesus, I think you might be for real. And if you are for real, I want to know somehow. I want to somehow know tomorrow morning. I want to know. And if you are for real, and I know, then I'm going to ask you into my life, and I will then recognize that you are God, and I'll follow you. I won't sort of like just be after the money. I'll do what you want me to do. And the next morning, it was the 20th of February, 1987, I woke up, and it was like I knew. Not just in my head, somehow in my heart, I knew. So I prayed. It was 9:05 in the morning. It was. The Christians had given me this little booklet, How to Become a Christian. So I went to the back. I'd read it a few times, and I knew there was a prayer at the back to ask him into your life. And I did. And it completely changed my life. Suddenly, this was a big shock, I started to care about people more than money. That was a massive, massive shock to me. And I suddenly began to realize that I had this five-year plan. I'd already got a place at Oxford to do a doctorate, that I was then going to go to the States to an Ivy League university, do some postdoc research, and come back, become a consultant, and earn my millions. That was my plan. And suddenly, it changed. I didn't want to do it anymore. Instead, I wanted to help people. So I ended up staying in Oxford, and we ran a big charity on the most deprived estate. We're now in Leeds doing some stuff there. But let's just move on to the story then quickly. So I then moved from Durham to Oxford. Next slide. There's Oxford, the Dreaming Spires of Oxford. And whilst Oxford in my first year, if you just go on to the next one, I'm down this little street called Turl Street, and there's a postbox. I'm going to post a letter. And as I post this letter, I meet this girl at the postbox who's also posting a letter. I knew her vaguely. We were in the same church. Her name was Catherine, Kate now. And I got chatting. And as she walked away, I thought, oh, she's nice. But I didn't have the courage to ask her out. So a few weeks later, I'm doing this research, working in this lab, and it's going all right, but not going great. And I decide, I'm just like new to all this Christian thing. I'm going to pray. I'm going to pray that God will help me. So I pray that he'll help me. I go back into the lab, and I get, in terms of the stuff I was working on, if you want to know the technical stuff, it was power electric laminated bulging monolayers, all right? Don't worry about it. We used to have one, but the wheels fell off, yeah? Forget about it. And I get the best results in the world, just kind of seemingly out of the blue. Three times better than anybody else had ever got. And so much better that all the machinery we were using to measure these things, we had to recalibrate it to be less sensitive because it was just going off the scale. My supervisor was very happy with me, the guy who's the professor. He takes me out for dinner, wines and dines me, more wine than dine, and I come back now with a bit of Dutch courage, so I go around to where Kate is, knock on the door and ask if she'd like to come around for dinner. And that's how our relationship started. We then went for our first meal out. I took her to an Indian restaurant, and she just bluffs it. She's sitting there reading the menu like she knows it. I later find out it's the first time she's ever been to an Indian restaurant. So she orders a prawn madras. I'm thinking, oh, girl likes a curry hot. It's all right. So I order one slightly less, and after two glasses of lemonade and half a bottle of water, with no impression seemingly made on this curry that my girlfriend is eating, I realise it might be a bit warm for her. So we swap dishes, and that's how we met. And 18 months later, we were married. But 2 weeks before we got married, I had the scariest news, if you just go on to the next slide, that I'd had in my life. I was at this place, this is the Churchill Hospital. I'd found a lump in my neck here. And I went into hospital, eventually saw the GP, I got appointed to the hospital. 2 weeks before I got married, I'm at the hospital. And they do what's called a needle test, which is a biopsy, where they stick a thick hypodermic needle in, take some of the lump out and test it. And they come back to tell me, I've got cancer. I've got cancer in my neck, and I'm getting married in 2 weeks' time. And I'm 23. I was petrified. At that moment, it felt like the floor opened up and I fell. That's how it felt. It was awful. And I go back home, and Kate comes around, and I tell Kate we're crying. But then somehow it's just like she's rock solid. It's like God just gives you this sort of like rock solidness right the way through what ended up being the next 4 weeks. So we decided we're going to get married. We get married. And all wedding photographs, there's us two smiling. There's my mum with this petrified look on her face all through all wedding photos because she was as worried as worried could be. And we go off on honeymoon for a week. And then we come back. And a week later, I'm going into the hospital to be operated on. They're going to take out the tumour. It's in my thyroid gland. And they're going to look at where it's spread and then kind of like give me the news of effectively how long I've got. But to my friends, pray for me. I'm stood in the lounge of one of them, he's one of the church leaders, and I've got my eyes closed like this, and they start to pray. And I've never felt anything like this before or since. And it felt like water came into my toes, rushed up my legs, rushed up my torso, into my neck, and this lump in my neck started to throb, bump, 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 like that. You know these cartoon characters where you see the hearts doing this out of their chest? It felt like that. And I'm stood there with my eyes closed, and I think, oh no, my neck's going to explode. It's going to make a mess all over the carpet. And this goes on for a couple of minutes, and then it just dies down, and the lump is still there. So I go into hospital, and I can remember as they stick the anaesthetic in that's going to put you to sleep. It's cold, so you can feel it running up your arm, then it's going to go into your heart, and boom, into your brain, you're gone. So you've just got 2-3 seconds at most. And I just prayed, oh, Jesus, save me, meaning save my life. And that was it. I was gone. The next thing I know, the anaesthetist is waking me up. I'm in the recovery unit. I'm on a stretcher. And as I come round, he says to me, good news, Mr. Colebrook. The tumour was benign. And I'm half asleep. And I'm thinking, I better just check that I heard that right. So I said, so you mean it wasn't cancer? He goes, no, it wasn't cancer. There was no cancer. Now, later on, I found out that I'd had my neck slit. I've got a big scar on my neck. My neck slit open with my head over the end of the operating theatre table for 2.5 hours as they dug around inside to try and find out where the cancer had gone because it had disappeared. I had a terrible crick in my neck. I was on morphine, believe it or not, for a week for a crick in your neck. It was that bad. So I'm coming round, and he says this to me, and I'm thinking, 4 weeks ago, you take a bit of that out and you test it and it's cancer, and now it isn't. There ain't any way that could have happened unless when those guys prayed for me, God did something beyond anything that we could actually expect, a miracle. So this is going through my head. So I throw my arms up in the air and I shout, hallelujah, thank you, Father, which I thought was a perfectly reasonable response in that moment. Right, not so for the anaesthetist. He falls on me to pin me to the stretcher, and he shouts, quick, nurse, he's gone delirious. Get more morphine. So I see this nurse running across the room with a syringe with the morphine, and bam, into my arm. It has no effect because I'm as high as a kite, right? I'm just thinking, God's healed me of cancer. You are not going to get me back to sleep. I'm staying awake. So I'm awake. And so I think, okay, I've got to tell her. I've got to tell this nurse what happened. So I tried to explain to her. I think, how do I start a conversation? Oh, I'm in England. I'll start about the weather. I can't move. My neck is terrible. So I kind of like vaguely look at this window. I say, oh, what's the weather doing outside? And she kind of like glares at me. And after about a minute or so of trying to get a conversation, she walks over to the phone and she phones the ward. She said, could you come and collect Mr. Colebrook from recovery, please? He's making a nuisance of himself. So just because I was excited, got to heal me, I get hoofed out of recovery. So that was my experience at the Churchill Hospital. And then we moved, we've just gone to the next slide, to this Blackbed Ladies. That's where we met Leslie, the story I told you about earlier. And then we moved 4 years ago to Leeds to start another church to help people make that connection with God. And also to start a big family charity called Flourishing Families Leeds that my wife runs. And then just the final slide. Here we go. This is us now. So it's me, Kate, my wife. That's our eldest son, Matt. His wife, Neve. Matt's doing maths. He's actually doing a doctorate in maths. And Neve is a theologian. She's doing a doctorate in theology. That's Steve, our youngest son. He's just finished a history degree in maths. He just started a doctorate in that as well. So they're all... I joke with them that they're all at university. That's Susanna. She's at Durham University, where I was, but she's doing French and German, which is what her mum did. And that is our dog, Frisbee, who's a Boxer Labrador cross, complete nutter, but great fun. So that's us. That's the Colebrook clan. And my three kids are all looking like they're trying to make university last as long as possible. You know, they're trying to sort of eke every last penny out of dad and mum before they do eventually, hopefully, go and get a proper job. So Matt has been there. He's in his 8th year. 8 years at university. Thinking, come on, mate. Go and get a job. Stop sponging off me. But he's they're all doing different stuff. And they're great. We love them to bits. So that's our family. And that's my story. And I think if I was to sum up my story, I'd say this, that when I used to say I was an atheist, deep down inside, if I was being really honest, I wasn't. Deep down inside, I kind of like knew there was someone out there. And deep down inside, I actually wanted there to be. But I had no idea how you could find a connection with them or anything like that. But I knew somehow something was missing. And that's probably the reason why this teacher had such an effect on me. I ended up doing the course he'd done at university. That's why these Christians, although they used to annoy me with their smiles and their sense of purpose and stuff and contentment, there was something about them. Because I knew something was missing. And that's probably what I would say if someone said, sum up your story in one sentence. Well, I knew something was missing. And eventually, I found it, or probably more accurately, God found me. And I have a little picture on my phone. When I was at Oxford, Oxford has got colleges with the university, and there's one college called Keble College. I'm just finding the photo to show you. And Keble College, in its chapel, has a painting hanging. There's a bigger version of this painting that hangs at St. Paul's Cathedral, but this is the smaller and actually nicer version of the painting. You may have seen it. It's that. It's called The Light of the World, painted by a guy called Holman Hunt. Anyone see that? It's a painting of Jesus holding a lantern, and he's knocking at a door. The door's all overgrown. And I remember one of the things that one of my Christian friends said to me at Durham, just a few nights actually before I prayed that prayer and asked him into my life myself and got a friendship with him. He said, Rich, there are times in your life when God draws close. Then he added with a grin, he says, don't miss it, mate. And then he walked off. But he was right. There are times in your life when God draws close. It's like times in your life when Jesus comes up to the door of our heart and gives it a gentle little tap. And we somehow know, but often, it was certainly true for me, I didn't know how to open the door. So if for you, you think, actually, you know what? It feels a bit like that. And I can look back and see there's times in my life when God's drawn close and he's knocked on the door a bit. Anyone have a chat? More than happy to have a chat to you. Because when you open the door, it's worth it. We're going to finish there. So it's now, well, we're right. We've got 5 minutes extra. So we've now got lunch. Lunchtime. Lunch is at 1 o'clock. I'm not sure.